This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We're on the road today. Well, I'm at home in New York City, but we are watching America's political fires burning all across the country with our Todd Zwillick on the road. He's down south this week. Tennessee is where he hails from today. Plus, high school sports in this country playing for a team of 100,000 homeless students, shooting for the goal of a stable future life. We're going to talk about that a little later this hour. Creativity is not something to crush, and sometimes our approach to ADHD does exactly that. We'll look at the science, the emerging science, of the imagination. But we begin this hour with Ebola. Here's the latest about nurse Casey Hickox. She was forced into quarantine upon returning to the United States from Sierra Leone. She's been released now, but larger questions remain about the best way to contain a disease that has proved devastating in West Africa and alarming in the United States. Speaking to NBC's Today Show, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie was standing firm on his state's new and stricter rules on quarantine.
Here's the bottom line as governor. My first responsibility is to protect the public health and safety of the people of New Jersey. And I will not submit to any political pressure in doing anything less than I believe is necessary. You know, I understand there's all kinds of protestations from the CDC, but we want stricter things than what they have been willing to impose. And now they're incrementally, Matt, moving towards our position.
No politics about hurricanes. Remember Hurricane Sandy? No politics about Ebola. Here's Governor Christie again.
First off, now six other states have joined us as well, both Republican and Democratic governors, as has the United States military, as has Dr. Bruce Butler, a Nobel Prize-winning physician who this morning said he favors our policy. Fact is that the CDC has been incrementalist on this. This newest guidance, from my perspective, is incredibly confusing. And by the way, what's the difference when someone is considered to be high risk? You don't want them on public transportation. You don't want them at public gatherings. And you want them to work from home. That sounds like quarantine to me, Matt.
Today, Australia issued a blanket ban on visas from West African nations affected by the Ebola outbreak, making it the first nation to shut its doors to the region, the first industrialized nation. Australia hasn't recorded a case of Ebola despite a number of scares, and Prime Minister Tony Abbott has resisted repeated requests to send medical personnel to help battle the outbreak on the ground in West Africa. Wendy Orant hears some ancient echoes in all these modern sound bites. She's the author of Plague, the Mysterious Past and Terrifying Future of the World's Most Dangerous Disease. And she says the oldest weapons used to fight disease are probably the ones most worth using now. Wendy, welcome.
Thank you.
So you know all about the history of these infectious diseases and how devastating they can be to society and how they mystify political organizations, villages, cities, institutions of all kinds. Without getting into any of the details, as you hear the controversies that are playing out endlessly on cable television, you've got the New Jersey and the New York controversies going on there. But what are you hearing our society going through as it confronts this?
Well, the terror of pandemic disease, a terror that has been circulating in our political consciousness for quite a number of years. But I think since our awareness of the 1918 pandemic, the great flu pandemic, which for a long time was known as the forgotten pandemic, and now is very much remembered. But since the reawakening of interest in that, I think there's been an obsessive concern with this idea of something coming out and smiting us and devastating our society. There was a fear, for example, of H5N1, the virulent bird flu that was circulating and still is circulating in Asia. People were terrified 7-8 years ago that that was going to become a pandemic that would destroy our society. And now the fears are focused on Ebola.
So you hear in the current controversies echoes of 1918, echoes of smallpox, echoes even of the plague back in the 14th century, right?
I think so. The terror of Ebola is not unlike the terror of plague or of cholera nearer to our own time.
And when societies confront this, you know, whatever the technology is, whatever the medical science is, whatever state of superstition is in terms of, you know, God may be punishing us all, which was the case in the 14th century. Every society and village has to make a decision at some point. What we need to do is separate the dying from the living, and that's just how it has to go. Isn't that sort of the history?
Yeah, very much so. I think in the whole notion of quarantine arose in 14th century, the 14th century Italian city-states. It refers to 40, which is supposedly the number of days you would have to be in quarantine before people knew that you were not, in fact, infected with the plague. And this is something that the Florence and other city-states developed to keep themselves safe. It didn't work terribly well, but they tried.
Indeed, the whole word comes from the medieval period.
Exactly. Quarantine, meeting 40.
And how do societies make decisions like this? And I'm not suggesting that we are advocating that sort of thing, but the prospect, certainly in Sierra Leone and Liberia, may be pretty close to the point where what you need to do is stop thinking about cure and think about separating the dying from the living and let things play out.
I would certainly hope not. That would not be something I would ever want to see happen. What we have to do in Sierra Leone is take care of these people. Unfortunately, many of their native doctors have already died. Sheikh Umar Khan, it's terrible, terrible loss. The leading infectious disease doctor in Sierra Leone, I believe, and a true hero. So they, because they've lost so many of their indigenous doctors, they need us more than ever. And I certainly think that you cannot rationally expect people to abandon their sick or themselves and just say, okay, well, let's just wall the rest of society off from us and let us go. That would be the worst possible way to treat this, in my opinion.
But looking at the sort of cold realities of history, is it possible that the focus on cure can become a mechanism of transmission of the disease?
Well, not if people are careful. Remember, Ebola is not the plague. When you're talking about the pneumonic plague, such as we saw in early 20th century Manchuria, that disease was uniformly fatal. And the only thing, and there were no antibiotics, obviously, supportive care did no good. The only thing you could do was separate those people because there was nothing else to do with them. But Ebola is treatable. And if we could actually give proper supportive care, the death rate, I've been told by people who know this far better than I do, would drop fantastically. You know, 2 or 3% of people might die of Ebola if they were treated on time and well enough. It's not the plague. So no, we have to treat these people.
Wendy Oren, journalist and author of Plague, The Mysterious Past and Terrifying Future of the World's Most Dangerous Disease, spoke with us from Atlanta, Georgia. Thanks so much, Wendy.
Thank you.
Ah, yes, some Allman Brothers in honor of the band's self-proclaimed last show ever tonight here in New York City. Over 40 years of tunes and tracks. We couldn't resist using them for our show music today. No better road music than the Allmans, so we thought we'd give Todd Zwillick a playlist on his political tour of the South this week. When we last heard from our takeaway political correspondent, he was in the Georgia home state of the Allmans. Todd was in Atlanta, to be exact. His first stop on a tour all week long, and as the election gets closer, he's moved down I-75. Take a look at the map. You'll find him this week stopping off at various points along the way. For those interested in a little digital stalking, we've tagged Todd for the week, so you can follow his progress at thetakeaway.org. Tomorrow, Nashville beckons, but here's Todd's latest dispatch as he drives north.
Well, I'm sitting in a corner booth at the Pickle Barrel in downtown Chattanooga, Tennessee. It's a dive bar. You could come here certainly for some rock and roll, for some beer, maybe a little bit of bourbon if you want. You could smoke a cigarette in here, too. And I've just come north on I-75 from the metropolis of Atlanta, where they're locked in a Senate race, and there that race is really about jobs and the economy, about outsourcing, whether or not you support Barack Obama 90% of the time. Well, here in Tennessee, over the border, there's a very different kind of politics going on. It's the politics of abortion. You know, Tennessee is a state, believe it or not, that is relatively progressive when it comes to abortion in relation to the other states around it. The reason for that is that Tennessee law prevents the state legislature from restricting access to abortion, or at least specifically restricting access to abortion. They can make laws about the safety of abortions, but they can't make new laws that simply make it harder to get an abortion for the sake of it. And now a lot of people want to change that in Tennessee, and that's what Amendment 1 is all about. Well, you have the churches and conservatives, pro-life groups pitted against Planned Parenthood, progressives, Democrats, you can imagine. It's sort of a return to the culture wars that we're used to from the early 90s or maybe even the 1980s. So Tennessee has really turned into a battleground that's very, very different from the Senate race of Georgia, where I just came from, and even from the Senate race of Kentucky to the north of here where I'm going next. No, Tennessee is really about whether or not this state is going to be a standout when it comes to abortion in relation to the other states around it. And that's really what's at stake here.
More with Agent Zwillick tomorrow as he goes undercover politically to take the pulse of Nashville. All this week, we are sharing your memories of sports in school, how it helped and shaped you. From Pompano Beach, Florida, Coach Carl, 1972, Alabama, race fights in school. Coach made all of us on the football team hold each other accountable. He told us we were brothers on the field and brothers off, so we took care of each other at school. It made me understand our skin color is just that. Our hearts and souls are connected. We all need to watch out for one another, not our government, we as human beings.
Jerome from Florence, South Carolina. My experience actually happened in middle school. Of course, basketball was the sport of choice in my neighborhood, and I had an asthma attack on the basketball court. Still, the coach and the team were very supportive. They didn't let me play anymore, but I sat on the bench for the rest of the season. And at the end of the season, when everybody got a trophy, I got mine as well. As an adult, I still suffer from asthma, but I don't try to play basketball anymore. It's just as well because I sucked at it anyway.
From Fort Worth, Texas, I was 125-pound center as a freshman in high school. I got my butt kicked every day, but I told myself I wasn't going to quit, and that experience helped me through my future life experience. Vancouver, Washington, I loved football. I had a bad knee injury that took me out early into my season. To stay engaged with the team, I started videotaping the games. At the end of the season, I sold a highlight tape for $5. I was blown away when I sold 500 copies. So I saw an opportunity in video, switched my focus to filmmaking, and I'm now a documentary filmmaker. Nice. Coming up, how sports in school is a way for homeless kids to put aside hopelessness and inject some ambition and realistic dreams into their lives. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. It's all coming up here on The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. And Moo.com, an online print and design company providing software and tools to create business cards, flyers, and triple-thick luxe cards. More at Moo.com.
There is a sports team with 100,000 members out there. They play different positions, different sports, in fact. But they are all striving for the same goal line, getting out of homelessness. It was the story of Cleveland's LeBron James and Oklahoma's Kevin Durant. It's the great all-American sports story, an athlete who comes from a poor family and reaches sports stardom. But everyone can't be a LeBron James or a superstar like Kevin Durant. Sports Illustrated spent 6 months looking into the stories of homeless kids playing sports, kids like Tarita Dixon from Oklahoma City.
I mean, you can't really describe being homeless. Like, it's depressing, it's heartbreaking, it's, like, overwhelming.
These are stories of hope. Tarita is a star guard at Northwest Classen High School.
When I started playing, it, like, boosted my confidence, my communication, my, like, attitude towards some things in life. The only thing that kept me going was basketball, my daughter, and my coach.
Tarita's story was one of the many stories that senior writer for Sports Illustrated John Wertheim told us in his series.
There are 1.2 million homeless kids in the U.S. per the Department of Education, and extrapolating from these school districts, we can safely say there are more than 100,000 kids playing organized sports, high school, college level, who are homeless. And what we found, not surprisingly, I suppose, is that they come from all over the country, and their circumstances are quite different, but there is a real homelessness problem in the U.S. And again, in sports and sports media, we hear the success stories. It's a very easy and common trope. But there are a lot of kids right now playing high school sports who don't have a home to go to after the games and practices.
Do their coaches know this? Do the schools know this?
The schools are getting better. And one of the ways we were able to do the reporting was through these homeless liaisons that a lot of the districts have. I mean, I think the record keeping is getting better. And what we found is that the coaches play this enormously outsized role, that in some ways it's pragmatic. It's bringing the kid a snack. It's come into my classroom before practice and I'm going to feed you breakfast. We spoke to a female basketball player in Oklahoma, Ty Dixon, and it's very clear. I mean, she calls the coach mom. It's very clear that this coach is her surrogate parent.
And the coaches can't do this to everyone. They can't be that for so many. I mean, they can mentor the really talented athletes, but there are plenty who don't have a chance, who there's no real opportunity for mentoring. How does that get handled?
That's a really good question. And the other thing, too, is that these are some fairly grave and significant issues that a lot of these kids are dealing with, and the coaches are in some ways very heroic, but there's not a lot of formal training. And I think it really changes a team dynamic in a lot of ways. I mean, one of the points of the story was sports are this great bomb of homelessness. And for a lot of these kids, this is what's keeping them in school. This is what's giving their day structure. In the best cases, this is what's taking them to college. But it's not a reciprocal relationship, that homelessness really undercuts sports, that hard to play your best when you're hungry, and logistically hard to be recruited when you don't have an address. And another way that it undercuts sports is that there's a real sort of team fabric, team chemistry issue when one player doesn't have a home to go to, or when the coach is giving disproportionate attention to a homeless player. That can really impact a team as well.
And what is the impact on academics and the idea that you would even perform in school as a backup to athletics if you're not going to make it in athletics?
That's a great question. The dropout rate among homeless teens is astronomically high, and what we found was that sports are a reason that a lot of these kids are staying in school. But yeah, I mean, we talk about sort of all the social pressures and all the academic pressures that come with being a high school student. Compound that with, no exaggeration, not knowing where your next meal is coming from. That's a lot for a 16, 17-year-old to undertake.
How do they speak about that? In the encounters that you had, how do they speak about the problem of not knowing your next meal when you're shooting free throws?
You know, I was really struck by how sort of flat and matter-of-fact they were. I am homeless. I'm doing this because I want a better life. And there wasn't denial, and there wasn't euphemism. Isaiah Lamb, who posed on our cover, very flatly said, you know, I want a better life. I've been homeless, and it's not fun. And fortunately, I'm able to overcome this. But this is one of my real motivations, is to have a better life.
Well, let's listen to Isaiah Lamb here for a moment, because he, like a lot of people, looks up to the huge stars in the NBA. But if you listen closely to this, the reason he looks up to them might be a little different than the reason you or I might look up to him.
Some of my favorite players are Kevin Durant, LeBron James. I can kind of relate to what Kevin Durant been through, moving to house. I can't even really remember the last time I slept on a mattress.
Bonded to these NBA stars because of their backstory, not necessarily because of their stats on the court.
Exactly, and I don't think we necessarily think of that when we talk about these endorsements and role models and shoe contracts. We assume it's aspirational. Kids want to dunk, and kids want to be Kevin Durant because he scores 30 points a game. And what we find is a lot of kids really, it's still aspirational, but a lot of kids really identify with what he had to overcome. Those backstories that sports media tell and that teams put out, they're really internalized by an awful lot of kids.
You know, and the LeBron story is in many ways a story of stats and of determination and of getting, championship rings. But if you look deeply at the LeBron story, it's about getting out of Akron and getting his friends out of Akron and giving back to Akron. And, I mean, there's no part of the LeBron story that isn't about, where he came from. And I think certainly the people on the street see that way more than the flashy announcers do on the networks.
I totally agree. And I also think that's one of the real underpinnings of this return, that there's a real deliverance through sports story, and the fact that it's Akron and Cleveland probably only adds to it. And the element, raised in poverty by a single mother. I mean, by DOE definition, he probably was homeless. And No, I think that's really perceptive, John, that this is about a lot more than a guy who went to Miami, won some championships, and is now going back to his old team.
But sports is not a panacea for these homeless kids. Sports is a moment in time for most of them, and then they return to poverty and misery and crime. And how do you deal with that as a reporter?
I think in general, we try to be a little bit skeptical of this deliverance through sports. I don't want to say myth, but the statistics do not favor everybody's going to be an NBA star. But, you know, in this case, it was really interesting talking to these kids. They did not talk about NFL dreams and NBA dreams. I mean, Isaiah Lamb's a Division I basketball player. He wants to be in the NBA as a trainer. He's not even thinking about making it to the NBA. And I think there's a realism among these kids. College is the goal, not LeBron James, not millions of dollars and generational wealth. It's getting to college. And I think that in some ways, these kids had more perspective on sports and what it could do for them than a lot of kids who are a lot better off.
John Wertheim is executive editor and senior writer at Sports Illustrated. Thanks so much, John.
Thanks, John.
A legal roadblock for abortions in the state of Ohio is playing out like a controversy in Texas that's now before the U.S. Supreme Court. Planned Parenthood's Elizabeth Campbell Surgical Center is the only abortion provider in Cincinnati and the city's surrounding suburbs. That clinic is one of only eight left in the state of Ohio, and it's been cited and could shut down over the issue of having to be affiliated with a hospital. The prospect looms of this major metro area being completely unserved for abortions the way things are proceeding right now. Joining us is Chrissy Thompson, state capitol reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Chrissy, what's happened here exactly?
In Ohio, we have a new law that was passed last year. We already had a law in place that required abortion clinics to function as outpatient surgery centers, and that meant they had to have a transfer agreement with a local hospital as a formality in case they had an emergency and needed to transfer a patient. But a new law that was passed last year said that they could only have those agreements with private hospitals, no taxpayer-funded hospitals. And private hospitals are often religiously affiliated, and so, at least in Cincinnati, none of the private hospitals agreed to form this agreement with an abortion clinic. And therefore, one of our clinics closed about a month ago, and the other one just received a citation from the health department for lacking this transfer agreement.
So the mechanism for closing down this clinic is very similar to what's been going on in Texas that's now before the Supreme Court, right?
That's right. It's not exactly admitting privileges, but it's a very similar law. And again, abortion opponents say taxpayer money should not be used to enable abortions. And so taxpayer money funding public hospitals shouldn't be used to help keep these clinics open. But this law is a formality. No hospital would turn away an abortion patient that was in an emergency.
And is this a statewide issue or is this just Cincinnati?
We have seen clinics be in trouble in the Toledo area. That's the other major metropolitan area that has had problems. The clinics in Columbus have found private hospitals, and the clinics in Cleveland have as well. There's one more clinic in Dayton, which is a little more than an hour away from Cincinnati. So that would be the closest clinic if the Cincinnati clinics closed. But that clinic also lacks a transfer agreement. And so there's a very real possibility that Cincinnati could become the largest metropolitan area in the country without an abortion clinic.
Which would mean how many people are affected?
About 2.1 million using that metropolitan area statistic. But again, the closest clinics to Cincinnati would be Columbus, which is about 2.5 hours away, Indy, about the same distance, and then Louisville, Kentucky, which is about 1 hour and 40 minutes. So you're looking at a lot of people in rural areas who would also go to Cincinnati if they needed to have an abortion.
All of these countermeasures, these compensatory, traveling requirements are very humiliating for people.
Well, and think about what is required. In Ohio, we also have that 24-hour waiting period, so you have to see your doctor before the procedure at least 24 hours in advance. And so for a person with means, taking a couple of days off work, you probably have paid time off, you can get childcare, You are able to transport yourself to the next metropolitan area over. But for someone who doesn't have means, who doesn't have paid time off, doesn't have paid childcare, this could put an abortion out of reach for those individuals.
Now, the Supreme Court test at this point, at least as it's playing out down in Texas, is an undue burden on the mother that would prevent her from having a medical procedure that is legal under Roe v. Wade. Is there a challenge afoot in the state of Ohio?
Not yet, but that is exactly what abortion rights advocates point to, is they don't think that if this clinic in Cincinnati were to close, that you could expect every person to be able to make the trip to another metropolitan area. They have asked the health department for an exception to the rule, which is legal, but our Republican governor, John Kasich, is over the health department, and the health department has stopped allowing those transfer agreements. That's the precedent they've set so far. So this clinic is certainly hoping that they do have an exception granted, but it doesn't look very good for them right now.
Chrissy Thompson, State Capitol reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kids get labeled in school: outgoing, dramatic, talented, shy, hyperactive. And then there's ADHD. This label can be profoundly determinative. ADHD is a label that can channel kids into special programs and sometimes narrow their options in college and high school. Psychologists have debated for years whether or not ADHD is an actual psychiatric disorder treatable with powerful drugs, or closer to simply a category of personality. Scott Barry Kaufman, scientific director of the Imagination Institute in the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania, says that the way our educational system and psychiatric system view ADHD may be seriously flawed. Kaufman says we should reframe the label as just people who have a more active imagination. And imagination, he says, is something we should be learning a lot more about.
What I like to do is look at the different characteristics that are associated with the label. It is a label at the end of the day. It's something.
It's a dreadful label.
It's something we put on people,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Especially in an educational context.
And some people, you know, embrace the label because it gives them certain advantages. Other people get stuck with the label and they can't get rid of it.
Right. Well, I think that everything is an interaction of genetic contributions and the environment, how we treat people. And even though there might be some genetic contributions, there most certainly are genetic contributions to some of the characteristics that we associate with ADHD, such as impulsivity, inattention, mind wandering, daydreaming. That doesn't mean that these aren't things that can't change, behaviors that can't change through different environmental situations at all.
I have a son who daydreams all the time. Sometimes it's incredibly frustrating, you know, when it involves cleaning up his room. But, you know, I often look at it as something that's wonderful about him.
Yeah.
And I see him daydreaming his way through all kinds of problem solving and into places that he develops all kinds of expertise, you know, music, that sort of thing. As a parent, how do you avoid ADHD as a way of kind of lumping all this stuff together?
Well, if you're a parent and you see that your child has a lot of a big need to act in the world and to be an active learner, I think that you should work with the administrators, with the teachers, to allow your child to do project-based learning, allow your child to do inquiry, discovery-based learning, to really be an active learner. And this is a broader issue. I think that all students should get the opportunity to be active learners. You give them an opportunity to actually take control of the learning process and be driven by their interior monologue, their interior fantasies, their interior daydreams, allowing the student to have some autonomy in that process, and you can see them flourish.
Do you think that teachers often are impatient with creativity and it becomes
Oh, yes.
a kind of ADHD sort of nomenclature?
Absolutely. I mean, they've done studies where they've had teachers rate all of the most problem behaviors that they see in the classroom from students. And they also had them rate the characteristics they think were most associated with creativity. And they found almost a complete overlap of the two categories.
So what does that mean about the educational system, in that we're aiming for some kind of normal, and that normal is not necessarily particularly creative, and therefore people on the fringe, people who have exciting and interesting talents, get forgotten?
Absolutely. It also means, quite simply, we don't value creativity. We don't value imagination either. Imagination is a necessary part of creativity. So every time that we force a student to passively listen to a lecture, something that the student's not personally interested in or personally doesn't see the relevance to their future life, we're robbing them of that opportunity to imagine their own personal futures, to imagine new curriculum that might not even exist yet.
I don't know how much data you have at this point, but fMRI studies on people with ADHD, what do they show?
Well, this is what's interesting. So it shows that there's this brain network, which cognitive scientists call the default mode network, which is what is most active when our brain is at rest. So we're just idle and we're just sitting there and people aren't competing for our attention. This brain network is most active. And I've referred to it as the imagination brain network because I think that's what it really is. All the cognitive processes such as perspective taking, daydreaming, mind wandering, moral reasoning all involve imagination. And it's very different than the kind of brain network which is associated with like taking IQ tests, for instance, which relies more on the executive attention network or like sitting at and paying attention to a boring lecture. So the latest research shows that this brain network, the imagination brain network, is highly, highly conducive to creativity and creative thought. And those who are diagnosed with ADHD seem to have greater difficulty than those not diagnosed with ADHD in suppressing activity in this imagination brain network. So in a way, you could actually conceptualize people with ADHD as having an overactive imagination as opposed to a learning disability.
And this imaginative part of the brain is actually something that is a feature of human brains. Our executive function is evolved from all kinds of sort of animal traits that involve survival, involve evaluating what's going on in the environment, who's an enemy, who's a friend, that kind of thing. I mean, you've got all the brainstem stuff that relates to pure sort of organic survival. In many ways, the ADHD that you're studying is this newly evolved function within the brain trying to kind of break out and maybe get a little more attention.
Well, let me tell you something. There's a research about 40, 50,000 years ago. You know, a band of us left Africa and we went to Europe and eventually conquered the world. In order to travel and go through such distance, it's been found there was a genetic mutation. And this particular genetic mutation associated with dopamine has been found to be associated with ADHD. So without these characteristics, we may not have become Homo sapiens.
So it's
just to be dramatic. Well,
it's conceivable that the dopamine content of Christopher Columbus's brain might have encouraged him to say to Queen Isabella, you know, I bet I could get to the other side of the world by sailing across the ocean.
That's right. You can think, because you can conceptualize ADHD people who we give that label to as explorers. That's what they are. They're explorers. How imagine being an explorer trapped in an educational classroom where the teacher is saying, pay attention to me and don't explore. It drives them nuts.
What's your personal dimension, personal connection to all of this?
Well, I was diagnosed with a learning disability when I was really young. I was diagnosed with an auditory hearing disability called central auditory processing disorder and was treated as though I was stupid for most of my educational experience, for a couple key teachers who really looked beyond the label and believed in me and helped me question my place in the hierarchy. I could assure you I would probably not have graduated high school.
Well, it's a remarkable and exciting view of ADHD and a really interesting contribution to the debate. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Scott Barry Kaufman is Scientific Director of the Imagination Institute in the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also a psychologist at Penn. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.